You are about to participate in the most ambitious culinary experiment ever imagined.
This competition is going to test everything.
Adapt quickly to anything. I mean anything. The wildest day of your life starts right now.
All new 24 and 24 Last Chef Standing. Sunday night at 8 on Food Network. Stream on Max.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello. Welcome to New Books and Music, a channel on the New Books Network. My name is Bradley Morgan, and I'm joined today by my guest, Hugh Hodges. Hugh teaches in the Cultural Studies Department at Trent University and has written extensively on African and West Indian music, poetry, and fiction. His latest book is The Fascist Groove Thing, A History of Thatcher's Britain and 21 Mixtapes, and is published by PM Press. Hugh, thank you so much for joining me today.
Oh, pleasure. Thanks for the invitation.
So first things first, can you just tell us what your book is about?
Well, The title is somewhat self-explanatory. it's a history of Thatcher's Britain, built out of 21 mixtapes based on popular music of the time.
So there's a lot to cover with both the music and the history, and let alone just one of those subjects. So there's some issues and artists that we'll discuss, but we won't explore everything here. So first, just for some context, could you briefly give us some history as to who Margaret Thatcher was and what her premiership represented?
Yeah, fair enough. So Margaret Thatcher was the leader of a Conservative Party, which had, up until the time she took over as leader of the party, had been swapping roles with the Labour Party in government, out of government, in government, out of government, for a couple of decades. And both parties were more or less centrist on various core principles. They actually agreed. There were differences, of course. But Thatcher's arrival as the leader of the Conservative Party represented, if not a radicalizing of the party, at least a refocusing of it towards neoliberalism and latterly social conservatism. She won the 1979 election for the Conservative Party very, very handily, defeating a Labour Party that had just gone through a very bad winter, axiomatically known as the winter of discontent, where any number of strikes happened. The country seemed to be in total disarray. Unemployment was on the rise. The British public were looking for people to blame for this, so they were happy to blame the unions and immigrants and various other groups who came to mind. Thatcher was more than happy to accommodate them by shifting the blame there as well. And so she arrived in 1979 with something of a landslide victory for the Conservatives and proceeded to dismantle the welfare state that had been in place since the end of World War II, essentially.
So the really fascinating aspect about your book is that you contextualize this history through mixtapes, and you document approximately 400 songs, which is rather impressive, because a lot of these music books that contextualize history are often through a single album, band, discography, or even genre, and this is a very unique approach to that. Why did you use this approach?
Well, I didn't mean to. When I set out, it was going to be much more along the lines of what you've just described. I had wanted to pick maybe one song as a way to talk about the Falklands War, and one song to talk about the miners' strike, and one song to talk about unemployment. And I very quickly realized that the point wasn't that half a dozen people had written interesting songs. The point really was that hundreds and hundreds of songs talking about Thatcher's Britain had been written. And at that point, the whole approach to the thing changed, where I realized I was not going to be able to do sort of in-depth literary analysis or even a sociological analysis of each song. And the whole project flipped. So that instead of it being a study of these songs, the songs became a study of the history that they were responding to. So yes, as you say, almost exactly upside down from the way most people have approached popular music in this period.
Well, I think it's a very path-breaking way to write about that, because what's really impressive is not just the number of it, but there's a variety, a huge variety of songs of just different subjects, different meanings, different genres. And I'm sure a lot of these songs you came across during your youth and coming of age and were part of who you are growing up. But how did you come across songs that you didn't quite necessarily know that might have come through as you were writing the book?
Mm-hmm. As you said, a lot of this stuff is music that was part of my childhood, my adolescence. Really, the starting place was The Clash and Elvis Costello and the Sex Pistols and various other bands that I listened to as a kid. I was listening to your podcast with Gregor Gaul, and he was talking about how when he was a kid, he wasn't so much a socialist as a clashist, which is, I love that phrase because I can fully identify with that. There was a time when literally everything I knew about the Spanish Civil War, for example, was from the Clash on Spanish Bombs, and even longer where everything I knew about the Spanish Civil War was because that song had made me go and look stuff up. So quite a lot of the material in this book is stuff I grew up with and that really did shape me as a teenager. But the collecting of the 400 songs here really was partly a process of moving from one thing to the next. Academic research goes this way. You go to the library to get book A, and the book right next to it turns out to be the one you actually want. And then the back of that, there's a bibliography that sends you off to half a dozen more books. So there was some of that. Some of it was, once you tell people you're doing a project like this, they have suggestions for you. Some of it was just browsing record stores. Writing this book gave me a spectacular excuse to rebuild the record collection I had when I was a kid and sold in the mid-80s to buy paint for art school. But then to go far, far beyond that and accumulate all kinds of things that I either never saw or never considered as a teenager. It was very important to me through the whole project that it not just be a book about political punk. That is sort of the obvious place to go when you're thinking about popular music and political commentary in the 1980s. But part of the point I wanted to make was that it was popular music quite broadly that felt it had something to say about Thatcher and about unemployment, about war, about nukes. So I wound up listening to a lot of music that I would have dismiss as a teenager. The House Martins, for example, were a band that just went completely by me when I was 15, 16. Revisiting them for this project, I have come to appreciate really quite profoundly.
That Clashes comment is so funny to me because it's really amazing how just through musical osmosis we get introduced to like a lot of ideas and historical context. And I remember in high school going through a big Clash phase myself, and in my history class dropping Boer War, you know, and if anyone had pressed me on any of that, I would never have been able to tell you what that was. But because I heard it on the track The Leader, you know, it was something that like, oh, you know, no one's going to be able to name check this for me. But that's so funny. And that variety and not focusing just on the punk is really fascinating, because one thing that's really interesting about your book is that these songs either address Thatcher or the results of her policies, but not always the same ideas. And we often find that even amongst like broadly shared ideals within a group, there's, you know, that narcissism of small differences. And they seem similar in a general sense, but represent these different philosophies. Were you surprised to find that out? And how did it influence your approach to writing the book?
As soon as I realized that this was going to be a book about hundreds of songs, I wanted to make sure I didn't create some kind of Procrustean bed where all of these songs somehow had to be speaking the same language and sharing some kind of coherent ideology. It was very important to me to communicate that, first, that there was plenty of disagreement about the implications of what Thatcher was doing and the consequences of what Thatcher was doing, but also that the bands themselves were very rarely coming at this from some ideologically fully worked out position. There were a few bands like the Redskins who were members of the Socialist Workers' Party, a few other bands with very, very clear anarchist principles. But mostly these were kids who were just reacting to the political environment. And many of them reacting based on the same kind of much more poetic than clearly political reaction to, say, The Clash. Joe Strummer was much more a poet than a politician, and his songs communicate poetically rather than by clearly laying out an ideology. So many of these songs in this book were written by people who, like me, were inspired by The Clash and confused by The Clash, got some sense of that there's an ideology at work here. There's something to be said. There are principles involved. And singing about it, writing about it, is one way to think through it. So a lot of the songs in this book are the kids thinking through their situation. So I didn't want to pretend that they all fit into some kind of clear theory.
So I really appreciate you breaking down, you know, the concept behind the book and the motivations behind it, because I think that context is very interesting. So now I want to start going into some of that music and that history. Your book opens setting the scene in March 1981. Can you share with us what was happening in Thatcher's Britain at that time?
So I picked March 1981 simply because that's when the fascist groove thing, or fascist groove thing, we don't need this fascist groove thing, by Heaven 17 was released. And I'd already picked the title at that point and was stuck on it, and thought I'd better make a point of it. So 1981, Thatcher had been in power for a couple of years. She had already begun the process of dismantling, as I said, dismantling the welfare state, dismantling the entire apparatus of post-war Britain in many ways. The years between the Second World War and the end of the 70s were characterized by the creation of the National Health Service, the nationalization of the steel industry, the automobile industry, the coal mining industry, the aerospace industry. They were all the commonwealth of the British people. And Thatcher's brand of conservatism looked at this and saw all of these industries that were, on the face of it at least, unprofitable because they provided employment to people who would otherwise have been on welfare, and said, well, that's just not right. We don't owe anybody a living. So by 1981, Thatcher had already gone to war with the Steelworkers Union and effectively won that fight. She was preparing for a battle with the coal miners. That would come in 1984, 1985. 81 was a year short of the Falklands War. We'll come back to that. 1981, unemployment in Britain had peaked at something like 3 million and was still on the rise, mainly because Thatcher's restructuring of the British economy meant a very rapid and almost total collapse of industries in the north of Britain. So there were areas of Manchester, for example, where youth unemployment particularly reached something like 50% for a period in the early 80s. So for kids, particularly in the north, but across Britain, it really started to feel like there was no future, in very much the sense that the Sex Pistols had pointed to 5 or 6 years earlier in Anarchy in the UK, that all the youth could expect was chaos and no expectations. So that's the starting point for the book, is this moment where the fascist groove thing, as the as Heaven 17 said, it was on the move, it was on the rise, both in the UK with Thatcher and with the recent election of Ronald Reagan in the United States. And it didn't seem to give a damn. It just did not seem to give a damn for youth. Well, it didn't give a damn for youth. So that's where we begin.
So as I mentioned earlier, a lot of these songs share generally the same kind of messaging within this. And you brought up Heaven 17's We Don't Need This Fascist Groove Thing, released that same time period. I want to get a sense of how did the aesthetics, how these aesthetic musical aesthetics were influenced by the politics, because you write extensively, just looking through the playlist and the context in which you explore them, there were considerable differences in the aesthetics, and not every artist aligned with groups like Heaven 17. There was an attitude of artists outside the pop mainstream, and I wanted to get a sense of how those politics informed the aesthetics and that kind of difference in approach, and even in some cases, just, you know, general cultural aggression.
All right. That doesn't feel like a short answer question. Are you interested in why, for example, bands in, say, Sheffield latched onto electronic music rather than punk as a way to think about what music should become?
Absolutely.
Okay. So, yes, let's approach it this way. if punk in its first flush in 76 was a space clearing gesture, an attempt to set the music industry aside and clear a space where the kids could do their own thing and make their own sound, where the establishment was not needed because proficiency and excellence and marketability were not required. By the end of the 70s, that initial impulse to create something new and untrammeled by commodity culture, untrammeled by business, had started to become uniform. It had started to become a kind of establishment of its own. I'm going to regret saying that because it was punk never got fixed, but it had become a bit predictable. And for some kids, it started to look conservative. In some ways, the whole business of guitars and drums was just too backwards looking, too much of a revival of 1960s garage rock, say. So for bands like Heaven 17, the possibilities created by electronic music were very much the possibilities that punk was hoping to realize in its first flush. You don't need to be a trained musician. You don't need a huge studio with a huge budget to make music. You can create your own music with a little bit of inventiveness. The Cocteau Twins, not the Cocteau Twins, Cabaret Voltaire, built their own electronics to make their music. All very do-it-yourself. And for Heaven 17, and before that for the Human League, the possibility represented by electronic music was something that looked forward, something that was bringing something entirely new and untamed into popular music. So I'm not sure if this is a terribly good answer to your question, but this is one I've got at the moment, which is that if we want to sort of map the sound of popular music onto the politics, the politics of the sound was its newness. You see that not just in the futurism of synth pop, but in all of the stuff that gets bagged together as post-punk. All of it can be seen as a constant attempt to create new spaces, to carve out new blank spaces that might actually point to a future.
So I think that was a very interesting answer, and I think you answered it really well. And I wanted to ask that last question because of a really fascinating quote from your book in which you quote political historian John Street, in which he says, "Whether pop music is banal or brilliant, it is political because it affects or reflects the way people behave. What it affects are the politics of the everyday." And I want to get a sense of what your thoughts are on that and whether when you were going through the book, any kind of preconceptions you had were challenged or even changed as you were going through the process of writing it?
Yeah, it's a good question. The I inserted John Street there partly because he's talking about something that I don't do in the book. Because what I'm doing is looking at this from a very high level and kind of picking bits and pieces, really, from a variety of subcultures, from a variety of scenes, and sort of sewing them together in a very tentative sort of way into a a quilted, exactly the wrong analogy, a quilted history of Thatcher's Britain. What I'm not doing is looking at the way music in the context of a particular scene, of a particular moment, a particular time and place, makes its meaning within that subculture. I brought street in there because I recognize that this is something that is missing from the book. If this were a history of the music itself, it would be a really serious omission. And certainly when I teach music and politics, teaching a course on music and politics at the moment, we're deeply concerned with the ways in which popular music informs, as Street says, the politics of daily life. But in this particular book, I'm much more concerned with how music comments on big P politics.
So in your book, you acknowledge that Thatcher took control of a country that had already been going her way for a few years, which resulted in poor education standards and significant unemployment. And this becomes the basis for blaming immigrants and whoever else for these grievances. And just even today, as an American, there's a mirror to that where, you know, Trump gets blamed for being the genesis of a lot of social ills in America, but those were already kind of underlying and he just kind of validated those viewpoints. So I understood that conceptually, that way. So with Thatcher, this is during the 70s as punk is getting more ground in the culture. Who were some of those artists during that time before Thatcher's premiership, and how were they addressing these issues through their music before her ascent to that premiership?
Sure. Okay. So yeah, Thatcher doesn't become prime minister till 1979. So really, pretty much everything we think of as first wave punk happens before Thatcher and is not a reaction to Thatcher herself. In many ways, the Sex Pistols are reacting to issues and situations that would become characteristic of Thatcher's Britain, particularly commodity culture and the lack of real opportunities. When the Clash write about career opportunities in, 77, they're very much, in some ways, they're very much anticipating the songs that appear in large numbers in the early 80s about employment and the lack of it. But in career opportunities, I think I mentioned this in the book, the Clash are complaining not so much about the lack of jobs available to them. They're complaining about the kinds of jobs available to them. They don't want to work making tea for the BBC. They don't want to be in the army or the air force. They don't want to be cops. They don't want any of these office jobs or factory jobs available to working class kids. So in some ways, the Sex Pistols, the Clash, Chelsea, all of these other first wave punk bands are responding to stuff that would become worse under Thatcher, but they're also responding to social conditions that Thatcher herself was a response to. I put this a little polemically in the book, but I'm pretty sure I'm not the only person to point this out. Matt Wally points out the same thing, that in many ways the Sex Pistols were saying the same kinds of things that Thatcher was saying about society in the 70s, that it was stuck, that there were no opportunities, that society had kind of run its course and needed to be blown up. So although Thatcher became sort of the flashpoint for political commentary in pop after 79. Correctly so. She really was the focus of, well, she gave her name to Thatcherism, right? Even though this book, by virtue of making it a history of Thatcher's Britain, kind of perpetuates the idea that this was all about Thatcher. In many ways, the politicization of pop had already started before Thatcher took power in 79.
So this economic disparity, it continues during the 80s, and it polarizes southern England, which you write was rather prosperous, from the north, and Scotland and Wales, which were not. Can you tell us about some of the artists and groups who were from those communities that were most impacted by that disparity and what they were contributing to this aesthetic and cultural dialogue about the economic struggles they were facing?
Sure. I might as well take the opportunity here to give my editor a shout out. Ramsay Kanan, who spotted this book and figured it could be actually turned into something that people would read. He was the lead singer and writer for a punk band called Political Asylum in Stirling in the mid-80s, up to the late 80s. And that band was in some ways connected to the what was called a narco-punk. Ramsay himself says he never quite figured out why, except, of course, that he himself was an affirmed anarchist and started an anarchist press out of his mum's house. So I've forgotten what the question was, Bradley.
Oh, I was just asking, who were some of the artists and groups from those areas that you write about in your book that were impacted by that economic disparity and put that into their music?
Ah, well, okay, that makes sense of my answer. Thank you. Yes, the bands that I knew least about in some ways coming into this project were bands like Ramsay's Political Asylum. The anarcho-punk scene was something I was certainly not part of and only very peripherally aware of in the 1980s. But bands like Political Asylum, like Crass and Poison Girls and Conflict, their aesthetic was conceived of explicitly as a response to Thatcher's very conservative, socially conservative, as well as politically conservative vision of Britain. Also a response to her essentially fascistic sense of Britishness. Although economically liberal, politically, structurally, socially, her instinct was to centralize everything, to centralize power in Westminster. And anarcho-punk can be seen as a pretty direct aesthetic response to that centralization. A spreading, a democratization of production, of creation.
So Thatcher was a proponent of a concept called popular capitalism, which was something that a lot of bands oppose. Can you tell us more about what popular capitalism was and its impact?
Yeah, the term popular capitalism kind of captures a couple of related things. The biggest part of it was the denationalization, the privatization of Britain's aerospace industry, the steel industry and so on and so forth. And it was sold to the British public as their opportunity to own parts of these privatized companies. In other words, it was straightforwardly selling off the Commonwealth of the British nation and selling it to those middle-class, upper-middle-class people who could afford a piece of it. So a straightforward redistribution of wealth. And this was part of what was meant by popular capitalism. The other part of it was the selling off of the nation's stock of council housing. And again, this meant selling it off to those people in council housing who could afford to purchase their council houses, vastly reducing the available stock of council housing, meaning that those at the very bottom of the economic pile were left with accommodation that could not be sold because it was so terrible. The third part of this was a series of deregulations that expanded the opportunities the city had, the financial sector had, to make a quick buck. Broadly, the impact of what Thatcher sold as popular capitalism was a wider and wider disparity between the haves and the have-nots. The haves predominantly being in the South, the have-nots predominantly being in the North. One of the symbolic key figures of this popular capitalism was the character Loads of Money, created by the comedian Harry Enfield. He was the character he created was this suddenly affluent plasterer from the south of England, making a fortune renovating the houses of people who had got rich off Thatcher's financial deregulation and selling off of the national, the Commonwealth of the nation. And Loads of Money, his catchphrase was, you know, shut your mouth and look at me, wad. And he would taunt people from the North with this wad of cash that he had. The character is most famous for the single Doing Up the House.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
So this popular capitalism thing was very interesting to me because a lot of bands were critical of it and its commercial influence, while some were not bothered. Throbbing Gristle developed it as like a concept for parody, but other bands like ABC kind of adopted and embraced this almost performance art element as a multinational corporation. And I, you know, for a lot of us who may be younger and don't necessarily remember the 80s, can you tell us about that multinational corporation approach that some pop artists took?
Yes, absolutely. Heaven 17, the band who give this book its title, they themselves, their first album was called Penthouse and Pavement. And the cover of the album features the members of the band doing business. They're making music, they're shaking hands, they're on the phone, they're not just a band, they're a corporation making music and selling it. And for Heaven 17, this was mostly a sort of punk gesture of taking on the music business and beating it at its own game, putting on suits, being business people, and not relying on the major record labels to get it done for you. For bands like ABC, I think you pointed to, aesthetically, what they were trying to do was also in some ways a bit of a punk gesture, trying to make something glamorous and glossy, almost out of bits of broken metal and leftovers. Their big album, Lexicon of Love, sounds enormous. It sounds like it cost $1 billion, but it was actually done fairly cheaply using pretty rudimentary techniques, and they just managed to make something huge and overblown out of not much. So there's that kind of approach. There's Heaven 17 with this sort of ironic approach to the idea of the pop band as business. Then you get Sieg Sieg Sputnik doing the same sort of thing, but taking it much, much further. They actually sold advertising space between the tracks of their first album. They didn't get many takers, but that this gesture of the full self-reflexive commercialization and commodification of their own music. And the band's aesthetic, their costuming and their album design was so lurid, so brash, so obviously artificial and so obviously designed to be sold, that even in that, there's this kind of space-clearing gesture, the sheer irony of selling something that is offering itself as an anti-commodity while desperately wanting to be sold as a commodity. Both Sieg Sieg Sputnik and Heaven 17 found out fairly quickly that there's a limited return on that kind of irony. You really can't beat business at its own business. Both wound up becoming increasingly empty in their attempts to sell themselves as anti-commodity.
What's really kind of funny and just kind of really ironic is I saw Heaven 17 last year in Chicago in Park West, and it was a really fantastic, entertaining show. And I can't imagine what bands like Heaven 17 or ABC in this kind of like pop multinational corporation aesthetic would have thought of their contemporaries who have gone on to, let's say, U2 doing a residency for a new venue in Vegas of all places. You know, it's really kind of funny just how that whole dynamic has just kind of evolved, and you know, kudos to them for just still having so much fun with it.
It is amazing how many of the bands that I mention in this book are still around, and not just the bands that have made a conventional music industry career out of it, sort of following in the muddy footprints of the Rolling Stones. Not just bands who are on a perpetual greatest hits tour, but bands who are still out there working. Oi Polloi, the Angelic Upstarts, Cockney Rejects, Subhumans, all of these bands that were never going to become the Rolling Stones, who are still out there, still making politically committed music, still writing new stuff, still engaging new audiences, still converting the young in exactly the way that Joe Strummer converted me as a kid. And it's inspiring. Even bands who do appear to be part of the machinery, and you mentioned U2, and you know this from writing about U2, places where they did engage with politics in the 80s and into the 90s, it's still relevant. I think you wrote a bit about them planning a couple of shows around the, was it 30th anniversary, I suppose, of the Joshua Tree, and realizing that the album was still, or again, so relevant politically that they actually needed to tour behind it for a bit and really revisit those songs because they still had something to say. And I think that's the thing that surprised me most writing this book was I started it thinking I was just writing about that moment, that moment was extraordinary, and the stuff that the bands were responding to was very much of that moment. And as I was writing the thing, it just kept getting, in a fairly depressing way, more and more immediately irrelevant, more and more obvious that exactly the kinds of fascistic, anti-democratic, anti-social things that these bands were responding to in the 80s are very much the forefront again. U2 can see it. The Subhumans can see it. Oi Polloi can see it. It's not just that these bands are out there on a perpetual nostalgia tour. They still have something to say, and they still have something important to say.
Absolutely. And that recontextualization of that art, and thank you for mentioning my book, even though we're here to talk about yours. I know, thank you for at least looking into it. That's much appreciated. That it's very important because there are a lot of parallels between the 1980s and today. And reading through your book, that comes through, and it's rather alarming. You kind of briefly mention a few controversies that Thatcher experienced during her premiership, such as the Falkland War, the miners' strike, and specifically, you know, what kind of stands out to me is how similar Thatcher's anti-immigrant rhetoric and her anti-labor rhetoric, you know, is reverberating. Even now, you know, especially in the U.S. where I am, this is also seen in other issues as well, such as the disarray caused by Brexit. Do you think something akin to Thatcherism is returning or could return?
Well, I think it has returned. I think in a number of very significant ways, Britain never stopped being Thatcher's Britain. The Conservatives did finally lose to the Labour Party in 97. But at that point, it was a Labour Party which, through the 1980s, had seemingly made itself unelectable by being genuinely socialist, reinvented itself in the 90s as New Labour, which was very much to say that its relationship to the Conservative Party was the same relationship as Coke and New Coke. It's the same thing. The Labour Party that was elected in 97 was virtually indistinguishable from the Conservative Party it replaced. So the neoliberal economic policies, the antisocial social policies, the ongoing assault on the welfare state, the privatization of everything and everybody, this just continued unchanged through the years of Labour government at the end of the 90s and into the 2000s. And with the eruption I want some unpleasant word to describe the arrival of Boris Johnson. But with the arrival of Boris Johnson, any sense that Britain had moved on from Thatcher was obliterated. The same kind of conservatism built around a highly charismatic and fundamentally evil character. I don't think we're heading for a new wave of Thatcherism. I think we've been in it for the last 40 years. It's just conceivably possible in the UK, at least, that we might see an alternative to it. It is just barely conceivable that a Labour Party with some kind of socialist principles might. I'm so unpersuaded by what I'm about to say. Might return to power in Britain. In the United States, I'm really, that's, it's a whole other thing. But certainly, if the United States could get back to the horror of the Reagan years and just be that badly off, I think that would be an improvement.
Oh, I mean, that's a really interesting. That's really fun. That's very interesting and funny. I completely understand that. So this parallels aren't just seen within the politics as well, but also in terms of culture and even music. In those controversies, you write about musical responses to that, such as Soul Deep being a response to the miner strike that was supporting the Women Against Pit Closures. You also have the Kill the Police Bill single. And even now, 40 years later, we're seeing this increased like weaponization of police as a force above being a service. They look like the military in a lot of ways. It's rather frightening. And can you just kind of just talk about some of those songs as maybe like things that we could actually hear now with new music?
Well, Ranking Anne's song "Kill the Police Bill" is a really good one to pick on. The kinds of issues she's pointing to there as being emergent in the UK are rampant now. Exactly the kinds of overpowered police force, the militarization of the police force, the fact that the police force is conceived of as a force rather than a service. These are all, you know, obviously relevant now. It's not as if she was pointing to new problems with policing in the UK, even at the time. The West Indian community through the late 60s, through the 70s, was the subject of more or less incessant police harassment. And when Ranking Anne wrote about it in 84, I think it's 84, with the Kill the Police Bill, what she was seeing was an intensification of a kind of policing that had already caused riots in 76 and 81, and would cause riots again later in the decade. So, yes, that's a very good example of a song addressing something that just hasn't changed, or if it has changed, has simply become worse.
The fact that some of these things are becoming worse leaves me to ask something that you write about in your book, in which some historians suggest that Thatcher's policies were necessary to correct economic issues from the 70s, and then we see the fallout from that. What is your take on these historians who are vindicating Thatcher or applying that kind of like, you know, rose-colored glasses to that history?
In some ways, looking at it from a very great height, it's almost inevitable. Everything gets softened. The edges get knocked off things. We wind up using short forms for historical moments. And from what is now a fair distance, it's easy to understand why what historians see is a kind of grand sweep. But what's getting swept away is the real experiences of millions of people who are negatively affected by Thatcher's policies. I saw an episode of The Crown recently. I watched it because it was the episode about the 1980s, about Thatcher, and was just sort of stunned by the reinvention of Thatcher as some kind of plucky, lower middle class, semi feminist icon, kind of strong woman standing up against a masculinist establishment and standing her ground. And in that episode of The Crown, there was no miners' strike. It vanished from that version of Thatcher. And the Falklands War was her being plucky. And to me, a really bizarre and kind of horrifying reinvention of Thatcher, who, in my recollection, represented a violent assault on most of what was good about Britain, being reinvented as someone who somehow saved Britain, despite the evidence that things have got just progressively shittier over the last 40 years, precisely because of the kinds of policies that dismantled not just the economy, but dismantled the social fabric.
That's a really important outlook, that kind of revisioning that you talk about in The Crown. I remember like a decade or so ago, there was that film, The Iron Lady, starring Meryl Streep, and a friend of mine refused to see it, and they had said, how fucking dare they make Thatcher hot?
Mm-hmm.
And it's it's that kind of same thing, really, you know?
Yeah. Well, okay, so in fairness to Thatcher, that's not a sentence I say very often. In fairness to Thatcher, the producers of that film were not the first people to imagine Thatcher being hot. Mitterrand, the French prime minister, he was quite taken with her. I think Reagan was quite taken with her. There was a lot of commentary at the time about her being in some ways sexy. And this speaks to a whole range of issues that I don't address in the book, because I'm not trying to be fair to Thatcher, and I'm not trying to recuperate her anyway. I'm not trying to acknowledge any of the challenges that she might personally have faced as a woman in British politics, or a woman in British society. Nobody ever commented on, you know, whether Jim Callaghan or Ted Heath or Harold Wilson was sexy or not. That's not something they had to confront. It certainly doesn't suit my highly polemical and unreasonable depiction of Thatcher for anyone to have found her on any level attractive.
Well, no, certainly your book is very clear about that, and rightfully so. But it does beg to ask questions about how much sexism played a role in critiquing Thatcher, in Specifically, in other words, do you think that if the same disastrous policies had come from a man in power, that we would have seen less of a critical response from musicians?
That's an extremely good question, and I wish I could claim to have given that some serious thought. I do. The fact that Reagan was enacting some of the same policies in the United States and elicited some of the same kinds of responses in popular music does suggest that it wasn't a question of Thatcher's gender. As we said earlier, the willingness of popular music to comment on politics was already in motion and strongly in motion before Thatcher came to power. The Jam spoke bitterly to Jim Callaghan, the leader of the Labour Party, long before Paul Weller moved to the left and became a critic of Thatcher. So that's not to say that there wasn't a fair deal of pretty vile sexism in the way Thatcher was addressed by popular music. But I don't think a male politician doing the same things would have received less criticism per se.
My motivation for asking that question wasn't necessarily for just an arbitrary presentism kind of outlook. I wanted to ask that last question because you write that people wrote these songs because Thatcher was so closely identified with the policies of her government and the callous way in which she implemented those policies. So I want to get a sense of why was this less so for other prime ministers? Was it purely just the personality or just the close identification?
I'm going to bracket off the question of how much of it had to do with her being a woman, because you are absolutely right that this was a part of it. But the reason she was so strongly identified with the policies is because they were her policies. Even though Thatcherism contained ideas that belong to any number of conservative thinkers, Thatcher sold herself as a brand, right? She was really the first British politician, certainly the first British prime minister, who, in the way that has now become commonplace, sold herself as a brand, as a media icon. And her party became her party. At this point, it's kind of difficult to reconstruct what politics looked like before Thatcher opened the door for demagogues like Boris Johnson and Donald Trump. We got so used to the idea that parties are now led by larger-than-life personalities that it's difficult to look back and see that what Thatcher was doing, at least in British politics, was something quite new, offering a media personality that was clear and easily defined and a short form for the government's entire political platform.
So it's been several decades since she exited office, and she's been dead for about a decade. Well, that sounds a little strong. It's been several decades since she exited office, and she passed away about a decade ago. What are some songs you would put on playlists for some of the prime ministers that have come along since Thatcher?
Well, there's not much. As I said at the beginning of the book, nobody ever wrote songs about Ted Heath or Harold Wilson or Jim Callaghan. You know, nobody's wrote songs about Gordon Brown or Blair. But there were there were signs that if he'd stuck around, Boris Johnson might have inspired something like the flood of music that Thatcher did. Boff Wally, formerly of Chumbawamba, and his choral group, the Commoners Choir, they released a song about Boris Johnson's head on a stick, playing on the fact that Boris Johnson's hair looks like a mop. There's a band, strictly speaking, a comedy band, a band called, anyway, they're called The Cunts, spelt with a K. They very nearly managed a Christmas number one a couple of years ago with a song whose title and only line was Boris Johnson is a fucking cunt. So not you know, particularly profound political commentary, but some sign that if he'd managed to stick around, and there was a danger he was going to, that if Boris Johnson had stuck around, he too would have become the subject of popular music political commentary.
So what you're telling me is that we should not expect Pete Wiley to come out with The Day That Theresa May Dies. That's what I'm hearing.
I think it's very unlikely that that any of the last half dozen prime ministers who seem to come and go weekly is going to inspire anything more than a very short Wikipedia entry.
Well, Hugh, this was a fantastic conversation, and I had a lot of fun. This book is incredibly impressive with a very fantastic concept. It's a brilliant work, and I think you should be incredibly proud, and I really appreciate your time in joining me today.
Thank you so much. I've really enjoyed talking to you.
My name is Bradley Morgan, and you've been listening to New Books and Music with my guest today, Hugh Hodges. His latest book is The Fascist Groove Thing, A History of Thatcher's Britain in 21 Mixtapes, and is published by PM Press.